On today's show, James Herbert of CBS Sports joins me to discuss what is the ceiling for the Memphis Grizzlies, how much better can the Cleveland Cavaliers be, and what, if any, is the case for optimism for the Miami Heat. That and so much more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Dan Devine. I am a senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, and I'm talking to you first today because Jake Fisher is off this week, which means that I'm the admiral of the NC Armada today, and it also means I need someone else to talk to. So joining me today, friend of the program, who does a wonderful job covering the NBA for CBS Sports, it's James Herbert. James, thank you so much for joining the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
It's my pleasure, and especially to have it at such a newsy time in the calendar, the first week of September, when we are beset on all sides by Davis Bertans and Troy Brown Jr. getting workout invites and partial guarantees for Talen Horton-Tucker, the stuff of an hour of podcasting. So really, we're going to be able to go run through all of that.
Maybe Dennis Smith Jr. will sign during the podcast. Who knows?
We might have to sub-segment that out into an emergency, like, inside podcast, like, incept our own show to do a Dennis Smith deep dive. Actually, I lied. We're not going to do a deep dive on those sorts of signings. In lieu of our usual five-out news segment, I decided we were going to do something and bounce around a little bit today, try to stretch our legs. The general idea is just, you know, we're coming out of the offseason. Labor Day, on the other side of it, is when teams kind of start stretching and yawning and coming back to work. We are about to head into training camp at the end of the month. And I was wondering, some teams that you are most curious about after all the dust has kind of settled with draft and free agency and trades, and we're going to kind of get to start seeing what these teams look like. So the homework I asked you to do was to pick three teams that you were pretty curious about. I would do the same. We would bat them around. But there was one important caveat. Do you remember what it was, James?
Yeah, there were some teams that were banned.
That's right.
And I almost picked one of them. Like I almost went with Golden State, and then I was like, I reread the list. I was like, oh yeah, I can't do that one.
Just to be a certified badass, you were going to make sure to pick one that was on the banned list. I respect it. I respect the power play. But yes, the rule was no Lakers, no Sixers, no Warriors. And the reason is just like, I don't think there's been any shortage of discussion of those teams this summer. There's obviously never any shortage of discussion of the Lakers and Warriors. Perhaps I am shooting myself in the foot with this rule, but I decided it might be fun to try to bounce around a little more, spread our arms a little bit wider, and embrace some of the teams that don't always get full discussion on shows like this. So with that in mind, and with in the interest of stretching our legs a little bit, James, why don't you kick us off? Give me your first team that you are curious about and wanted to discuss.
So I'm really curious about Houston. This is a team that finished the season pretty strong last year. They have the guy who I was most excited about in the draft, and Reed Shepard, who, judging by his summer league performance, is going to be ready to step in and contribute something right away. Exactly what that something is, I mean, we can't just assume he's going to come in and shoot just as well as he did in summer league. But I mean, he was like a historically great shooter last year in college. So if at least that part of his game translates, that's a difference-making ability, right? Like, he can shoot in basically any situation. He's comfortable on and off the ball. Like, I think, you know, it's kind of between him and Zach Edey in terms of, like, who people are projecting in the preseason to win Rookie of the Year. So that addition is interesting. And then beyond that, like, I'm pretty optimistic about this team in general, but I do have a lot of questions. Like, I think there's a lot of stuff that we kind of just don't know right now. Like, what exactly did that late season surge by Jalen Green mean? I think if it was a late season surge that continued right until the end of the season, there would be like a little bit more optimism, but it was like kind of in March, right? And then right at the end of the regular season, his efficiency dipped down a little bit again. So it's like, how much of that was a real encouraging step forward and improvement? How much of that was just kind of a hot streak? They have Steven Adams on the team now, which, I mean, that seems like, first of all, great hang.
Absolutely.
Second, I think he addresses some of the weaknesses on the team, right? Like, this team fouled a crap ton last year. He's one of the best centers in the league in terms of defending without fouling, being really, really physical, dominating the glass, but not picking up those ticky-tack fouls. I think he, whether, you know, he's probably just backing up Şengün at this point. But, you know, I'm curious, can they play together at all? What does this rotation look like? What to make of Amen Thompson, one of the top five most exciting players in the NBA, who played his best stretch of basketball last year, essentially playing like a big man, but also has point guard skills and is this incredible passer. So they have this like glut of guys in the backcourt. They have kind of a glut everywhere, right? Like, I don't know how many minutes like Cam Whitmore is going to get. I assume Eason is going to play a big role and like probably will be healthier this year. Dylan Brooks, is Dylan Brooks going to, you know, play a ton of minutes and play really physical defense and piss people off and probably foul too much? Like, but, you know, like I love the Dylan Brooks experience. So I think it projects to be a better team. I like the way that Shepherd in theory fits with Thompson. I like the way in theory that Shepherd fits with Fred VanVleet, who had a low key like great year last year, and the Rockets offense like was terrible when he wasn't on the floor. Maybe that won't quite be the case this year because they have Shepherd in the mix. But you know, I'm also kind of hesitant to just bake in, all right, they're young, they're getting better, they added pieces, they're going to make like a 5-10 win jump, just because the West is so insane.
Sure.
They could be like qualitatively better and win about the same amount of games and be still like in that same spot fighting to make the play-in at the end. Like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's a ton there. I think you're right to say that this is, it's basically just like a radioactive lump of clay where like it can still be anything and there's a ton of energy in it. And there's a lot of excitement to be sort of gleaned from it. That the rise of the Rockets last year was primarily on the defensive end, right? Ime Udoka comes in, Dylan Brooks comes in, Fred VanVleet at the point of attack. They all of a sudden are like a near top five defense. And that was consistent all year long. The offense was up and down. And as you mentioned, when VanVleet was off the court, it was kind of disastrous. Jalen Green was the headliner in the early part of the season was Alperen Şengün, who wound up, you know,
huge leap,
absolutely massive leap. And then wound up, you know, like meriting all-star conversation consideration. You know, had he made enough, played enough games? Actually, I don't really remember where he landed in terms of like, was he eligible for awards or not? That all becomes a real big mess at the end of the year with, you know, how much guys, you know, what percentage of available, whatever. Anyway, he's really good and he's a center, but also as the ball skills in the offensive game to potentially play the four. I think you're right to say, could Adams and him play together and that would more size there be an even bigger, you know, boon to them on the defensive end and also offensive rebounding, which Steven Adams is, you know, a central casting like masher down there to create more possessions when you don't have more guys who can't shoot. That's a good thing. Memphis Grizzlies learned that in a big way when he was there. He's also coming off like an entire missed season and, you know, missing the end of the previous season. So there's questions about what he can give you. But we've seen several iterations of this team be intriguing. Jalen Green has had that like March run, I think, a couple of times already in his career. And you're like, well, here it is. The light's on. And he'll average 28 a game for a month and then go 3-for-16 for 2 weeks. And you're sort of like, and then when he's doing less in a more harmonious environment, you're kind of wondering, why isn't he doing more with those other talents that he's got? Like, I think there's so much to be figured out there. You mentioned the Reed Shepherd point that I'm interested in is, if he is the ball handler and shooter and like event creating, havoc wreaking defender, like he was a steals and deflections, like magnet hands menace at Kentucky, right? If he's all of those things at the NBA level, there's going to be some guys in Houston who are out of a job, because right now that like backcourt mix and wing mix is so stuffed with VanVleet, with Jalen Green, with Dylan Brooks, Amen Thompson, Reed Shepherd, Cam Whitmore, you mentioned. Tari Eason missed most of last season. They bring back Aaron Holiday as sort of like a third point guard. But there's just going to be a lot of guys fighting for minutes and then on the outside looking in. And then that leads you to what kind of opportunity might there be for a consolidation trade if that's the direction you want to go. There's also the question, like contractual questions. Jalen Green's up for an extension. Alperen Şengün is up for an extension. They are probably not going to get them before the start of the season, although we'll see how training camp unfolds. Who then are your building blocks, right? Does Reed Shepherd as the number three pick, but a guy who a lot of projection systems suggested might have been the best prospect in the class, does he come in right away and like elbow everybody out and say, I'm now a core piece here? I think they are an interesting team. And the fact that they finished 41-41, you mentioned that late last season run, I think they were 17-11 after the All-Star break. You know, one of the better point differentials in the West after the All-Star break. Run out of gas down towards the end. The Warriors wind up acing them out for the 10th seed. Their over-under on BetMGM is, I think, 43.5 this year. So they finished 41-41 last season, bumping them up a couple of wins. It still only has that. That's like the 10th highest in the West. So they're still on that play-in out of the playoffs bubble. But I'm wondering, what do you think is the thing they would need to get to move up from there? Like what vaults them out of 9, 10, 11 and into pretty safe considering like mid-40s in the playoff consideration win total? Like what sort of, where's the elevation coming from for them?
I think, I mean, you alluded to it earlier, like it's mainly just improve the offense. You could make, you know, improvements around the margins on defense, like I mentioned the fouling thing.
Yep.
But offensively, there are a number of paths there, right? Like, I think Steven Adams, while he doesn't fit the profile of a guy who is like an amazing offensive player the way most people think about it when you say great offensive player,
sure, right.
Like you saw in Memphis, like how he made the team better offensively. He's one of the best screeners in the NBA. And then he just like grabbed them a ton of extra possessions. And that made an enormous difference. That was basically like how they scored their points, but they scored their points in transition, which they were getting in transition partially because he would box like three guys out at the same time, right. And they wouldn't give up offensive rebounds. Then they made their hay and second chance points on the other end. And like, can he do the same thing here? Is he just going to be the same guy? The Rockets certainly hope so. Like, we don't know. And then you're counting on, you know, improvement from Jabari Smith, improvement in terms of consistency from Jalen Green. I think maybe, you know, a shot profile from Fred VanVleet where he doesn't have to take as many pull-up threes, deep contested threes that he did last year. And he's good at those, but he's incredible at open spot-up threes. Like, he makes like 42-43%, some years higher than that. And if he can get those, then like he'll look like a more efficient player while being the exact same guy that he was, but it could just be a function of the offense getting better and other guys creating those kind of shots for him. And then I think, you know, the other way, beyond also the Shepherd thing, just him adding an injection of offense and another guy who can, you know, get stuff done for them when VanVleet is sitting. The other way is that they go and they change the team more. And that's the thing. Like, I think there's a universe where if you just like look at this roster and you know nothing about the past few years, you don't know who the coach is, you don't know who the owner is, you don't know who the GM is, you can just say, all right, like Shepherd and Thompson, they kind of seem like the backcourt of the future, and it's as simple as that. And they're going to kind of transition into that being the thing. And like, maybe that is what ends up happening. But I think, I don't know that you can even pigeonhole Thompson as a backcourt player. He's just kind of a freak that can do whatever. second, like Jalen Green was the second pick in the draft. And I think we need to see what they do with him. If he is still a core part of the team, if he ends up actually being involved in a trade instead of just us hearing rumors about him endlessly. There were even rumors about Şengün potentially being available. I don't think that was ever actually the case that he was available in the summer, but I don't know. What I do believe is that Udoka wants to win like soon. Yes, I think ownership absolutely wants them to be in the playoffs, wanted that last year. That was the point of bringing in Brooks and VanVleet in the first place. And there's like clearly an appetite to go and do a consolidation move, I think. There was that reporting about them trying to get Kevin Durant from the Suns in the offseason that I don't think we should forget about for one second. Like, just because they weren't able to swing a blockbuster in the summer doesn't mean they won't be the team that pounces when some superstar gets itchy a couple of months into the season. So we could be talking about a completely different team at this deadline. And even if we're not, like, I think there is a chance that this offense is at a different level than it was last year through internal improvement and the additions that they made.
I want to shift to a team that the offense was already on a different level and where I think they made their transformational move in the middle of last season and it paid pretty huge dividends. The Indiana Pacers are interesting to me. I'm curious about them because on one hand, all of the conversation about the Eastern Conference power structure has been about who can topple Boston, the Knicks being a reloaded team after their offseason moves, the Sixers being, you know, having the tailor-made central casting big three with Paul George there. What are the Bucks, you know, with a year two of Doc and Giannis and Dame together? And it's like we forgot that the team that played in the Eastern Conference Finals is also coming back. So here, what I'm curious about is what does the encore look like, right? Is it possible that this Pacers team isn't, I mean, I think the glass half empty view is, are they the 2021 Hawks, right? Where they rode a great offense and some lucky breaks in terms of matchups to a conference finals berth. And then like that set an unreasonable level of expectations for them. And that's possible, but it's the beginning of September. So let's be optimists and look at the glass half full and say, why are they not going to be like a 50 plus win team? The last time we saw Tyrese Halliburton healthy, he was maybe the best offensive player in the NBA who wasn't Nikola Jokic. They got as far as they got with a half season of Pascal Siakam and a half season of Halliburton on one leg. They, you know, there's backcourt depth. There's youth to be sort of excited about. I don't know. Where are you on the Pacers as we enter into this this new season?
I am not judging them like a typical conference finalist. Like, I don't want to say they're the Hawks because that feels derogatory. But
parentheses
also,
derogatory as opposed to parentheses complimentary.
Yeah. But I do, like, I'm encouraged by what we saw. Like, the Siakam move, I think, worked beautifully for them in the second half of the season. Probably became more important than they even realized it would be just because Halliburton never quite got back to what he was early in the year. Even though he had some incredible games in the playoffs, I think it was huge for them to be able to have somebody else who could create, somebody especially who could create out of ISO, which is not even like Halliburton's main strength, right? Like, he's an incredible pick and roll guy, like really great creator, a guy that completely kind of changes just sort of the feel and the flow of your offense and does so much for you in transition. But Halliburton isn't like your typical one-on-one creator type. And Pascal, I mean, like the shots he was making in the playoffs, like he was being efficient on like a superstar shot diet, like making a ton of contested mid-range jumpers, like just like tough twos and hitting big shots when they needed them. Like I thought that worked out really well. The defense improved after that trade. I think the big thing this year is, are we assuming they're going to be a historically great offense again? Halliburton's going to be this all NBA guy again from the jump. If we sort of give them that, then I think there is a big opportunity for them to be, you know, maybe a low 50s win team somewhere in there if the defense improves. Last year, they ran kind of a crazy defense where it was sort of a gimmick, right? Like they didn't want to give up any threes and they were like effective at doing that. But teams were just getting to the basket and scoring. Yeah. And, you know, there was some improvement in the second half of the season, but like with a full training camp, with kind of, you know, an understanding of what they did last year and like a collective sort of, all right, this is going to be our formula this year, where they emphasize a little bit more. I think we could, I'm assuming we're going to see a different defensive game plan for one. And then we just have to see what it looks like in terms of the actual execution of it. Miles Turner, a couple of years ago, we talked about him like an all defense candidate, like even a defensive player of the year candidate. He was giving quotes about how it was unfair that he never actually got real buzz for that award. And like, look at the stats and all that stuff. And like, you know, like that was, you know, valid. He was an incredible defender. I don't think he was an incredible defender last year. I don't think anyone on that team was, even though there are some guys individually who are good defenders. But can he get back to that level? Can they, you know, still be like able to, you know, take away threes and like without just making it that red carpet to the rim? Like, I want to see what they do on that end. And I want to see, you know, like, this is a team that has a couple of guys who were either in the mix or like not. Like Ben Mathurin is an important part of that team who we just didn't see because he was hurt at the end of the year. Yeah. I want to see how he
grows.
Torn
labrum, missed like the last 3 weeks and then the whole playoffs.
Yeah. And he was the guy previous to Siakam that they would actually like kind of give the ball to and say, get us a bucket a lot of the time when they needed it. Like he is a very talented one-on-one player, but like the flaws are well documented too, in terms of the feel, in terms of playmaking for others, in terms of just general defensive awareness and commitment and all of that. So right. Like we'll see where he grows. And then Jairus Walker is a guy that like NBA nerds like you and me, like we're all pretty much in on him. Like if you say that you're not interested in what Jairus Walker does next year, I will be shocked because I mean, he has all of the tools and you watch him in summer league or like G League highlights or whatever, like you can see the vision. But if he is strictly a four, then when does he even get in there now that like, you know, they have Pascal and they brought Toppin back. So like I have questions, but I'm certainly not going into the year thinking, all right, if they're a first round out, it's like some sort of, you know, massive failure or anything like that.
Right. The progress isn't linear and it might, you know, they could be, as you mentioned with Houston, they could be qualitatively better, but maybe not dramatically improved in the win total or in terms of their postseason, you know, equity. Well, now I have to go ahead and cross out the portion of this that was about Jairus Walker. Sorry. it's just in order to not look that much like I'm a predictable nerd. But yeah, I mean, they do need a versatile defensive four. And it's also worth noting that I don't know if this is worth noting or not, but I'm going to note it. Every time I look at him, I think he's sort of like young Paul Millsap with a wig on. So I'm like, like dimensionally and structurally, like it makes a ton of sense.
He's huge.
He's massive. He's absolutely huge. And he moves way, way better than a guy that big has any right to. But you're right. He might not have much room to move behind Pascal Siakam and Obi Toppin in that front court, especially now that, you know, with Miles Turner there and Isaiah Jackson, they bring in James Wiseman. There's like a lot of guys for those front court minutes. They're deep in weird ways, sort of all over the place. They've got maybe the deepest backcourt in the league. You bring back Nembhard on the extension. You extend it to TJ McConnell. But, you know, multiple ball handlers that can do stuff. The defensive component that I'm interested in, and they were, I think, 20th on the defensive end after the All-Star break. So not good, but if you are like approaching mediocre with the offense they can have,
yeah,
I think there's a real chance there. And you remove like Halliburton's gonna get hunted and they're gonna go with that, like, you know, Steph style high tag switch, you know, show and recover kind of defense to try to get him out of harm's way. Moving off of Buddy Hield, elevating Ben Shepherd, I think made them more stable in some, you know, they gave them some more flexibility and just some more like size and width and length and aptitude as far as like wing defenders. If Mathurin can take a step there, Aaron Nesmith is an absolute, you know, just like a bull there. There's more guys who can do stuff defensively at the risk of sounding, you know, really high-end analysis. There's more guys who can do stuff and who have like big wide bodies with arms that are longer. Maybe not all wing-sized wings, right? Like the perfect central casting three to guard an opponent's number one perimeter scoring option. But it feels like there's some more, you know, options in the cupboard for Rick Carlisle and that staff to come up with something. And I really think there's a chance. I mean, obviously, Tyrese Halliburton didn't get a whole heavy workload with Team USA this summer. So maybe he's coming in rested and ready. But I think that there's a chance that if he is if the start of the season, if he's healthy enough to be, you know, with the back issues he had, with the hamstring issues he had, those things can linger. If he's right at the beginning of the season, and they've got the full complement of training camp and everything to sort of iron out some of the wrinkles, how Siakam work together, how Siakam and Turner work together defensively, schematically, I think there's a chance this team could be awesome. And
yeah,
they get a little bit left by the wayside because they didn't make big splash acquisitions in the summertime like some of those other teams that we talked about. But I think we ignore them at our own peril because I think the fundamentals of what they showed seem stronger to me than, you know, insert that, you know, that Blazers team a few years ago, that Hawks team, like these sort of one and done teams. Maybe they don't get back to the Eastern Conference Finals, but I think they're going to be heard from before all is said and done. James, we're going to take a quick break to pay some bills with some ads, and then we're going to be right back with some more No Cap Room and some more teams that we are curious about. Stick with us.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to No Cap Room. I am Dan Devine. I'm joined by James Herbert of CBS Sports. We are talking about teams that we are curious about heading into the 2024-25 NBA season. James, you are up next. Give me team number two.
My second team is the Memphis Grizzlies.
Yes.
yeah. And this time last year, when did the Adams injury, that happened in the preseason when we actually knew he was going to be out. This time last year, a lot of people had them projected to be like first in the West, and then all the worst stuff imaginable happened.
Absolute year from hell for them. Yeah. Really like 18 months from hell, like for that franchise.
Yeah. And like, you just like pull up like their roster from last year. It's like John Morant played 9 games. Marcus Smart, their big offseason acquisition, played 20 games. Desmond Bane played 42 games. Brandon Clark played 6 games. Luke Kennard even played 39 games. Like, and when he did, he didn't like really increase his usage or shot attempts or anything like you would expect when you just had a decimated roster. But he'll make a lot more sense if they have their full complement of players. Look, if they did absolutely nothing, just brought back, like if they had like kept Steven Adams and just brought back the team that we were supposed to get last year, I would be really interested in them, because I was really interested in them a year ago and I thought their ceiling was pretty damn high. You get to be curious for other reasons, right? Like, we now get to see what Vince Williams, who I loved watching last year, who, you know, I thought he was able to showcase a lot of stuff beyond just the fact, all right, he's super long and strong, and like he is that sort of central casting. He can actually guard superstar players, wing guy. But later in the year, when they like basically didn't have any of their guards who could create, they had like a sort of equal opportunity offense where anybody could initiate, and you got to see he had some sort of like point forwardy skills. Like, he's not going to actually run the point, but like he can do stuff off the dribble. He has an offensive game too, and so I thought that was really good for his development. You got to see GG Jackson come into his own. Now he's going to be out for the first 6 weeks or so of the regular season, and then we'll see how he reintegrates. But you know, there is a world in which the Grizzlies just go on an absolute tear and they're the one seed halfway through this season, and the stories that are written are about how that season from hell came with these like little secret benefits to their young players, and they were able to establish this other stuff. And hey, they were able to get Zach Edey, who maybe at that point will be the front runner for rookie of the year for them. So I'm curious to see how much Edey can kind of handle right away. He played enormous minutes last year. I don't know if they're going to ask quite the same of him, but maybe that's a good thing. Maybe in terms of like how he plays defense, he's a little bit more aggressive in terms of protecting the paint. Offensively, I think he's going to be a monster. His screens are going to be absolutely like just brutal. And apparently he's been working out with John Morant all the time, getting that pick and roll chemistry going. So I want to see what that looks like. I'm just excited about the Jaw experience again. I thought Bane and Jackson offensively took steps forward individually last year. Bane, it was like really obvious what he did. Jackson, I think just he had to do more with the ball. He had to post up more. And I think that'll be good for him. And if you actually look at the 9 games where they did have Morant last year, it didn't just become the Jaw show. Like, Desmond Bane and Jackson each had enormous individual games during that stretch where Jaw was like looking for them. And it, in some cases, kind of deferring to Bane as a playmaker, which I don't think would have happened in the same way a year prior. So the theory of it is they're going to be kind of a three-headed monster offensively. Jaren Jackson will get back to being the defensive player of the year that he was the season before. And this could be an absolute powerhouse. I don't know if it's all going to click. I don't know. Like, is Marcus Smart like a small forward now? And also just how good is he at this point?
Yeah.
Because we didn't see him last year. And even his last year in Boston was not quite as good as the year in Boston before when he was the defensive player of the year. But generally, I mean, I'm quite like bullish on this roster. I think they could win a ton of games. It's just there are all sorts of questions, like, you know, beyond the stars, like what the hell does this rotation look like? Which of the forwards are actually going to play? Like, will we be talking about Jiddy at all? I certainly hope that we are. But I don't know. Like they have a lot of guys, and they have a lot of kind of things to figure out. And they're also like, there's a lot riding on a rookie, which makes me nervous.
100%.
But not so nervous that I wouldn't pick them to win a ton of games.
I think that makes a ton of sense. The last times that we saw that three-man core of Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, and Jaren Jackson Jr. healthy together for an extended stretch, they won, I think, 51 and 56 games and were the two seed both years. Yeah. We never got any answers to the questions that we had heading into last season. As you mentioned, like, how does Smart fit next to Morant? How does he fit between Morant and Bane? You know, what to make of those, some of those deep bench guys? I mean, we got answers on, like, negative answers on, is Zaire Williams going to be something? Is David Roddy going to be something? The team obviously decided they don't think so, and so they moved on from those guys. But in their place, they were still figuring out. I mean, they think they are higher on Jake LaRavia after a couple seasons of development. They added a couple of guys with Jalen Wells and Cam Spencer as like more of those big combo forwards who can maybe shoot. And so they're constantly trying to find answers on the wing there. The G.G. Jackson
even
thing,
Scottie Pippen Jr., a point guard, like I thought Pippen and Wells were two of the better players in Summer League this year. Like there's exciting stuff happening like deep in, on this roster too.
Yeah. And I think the concern is, I mean, well, there's concerns to find like, half-court offense is always going to be a point of contention, concern when you don't have enough shooting, which has been the case for the Grizzlies for forever. You have written wonderfully on multiple occasions about their sort of dominance of the possession game, the way that they have turned that weakness into sort of a strength with their offensive rebounding, the way they play defense to create transition opportunities, some of those sorts of ways of juicing the math in their favor, which obviously then sometimes in the playoffs, it's a little bit tougher to come by those buckets. But in theory now, you can, I mean, I've mentioned this before, they had like a vanishingly small amount of time two seasons ago where they had Ja not suspended and Bane and also Luke Kennard on the team. And they went like, it was only a few minutes, a few dozen minutes. But getting two shooters like that with around Ja, they've absolutely set the world on fire in that small sample. And I'm like, there's maybe more ways to get to that. They seem like they're maybe thinking about tweaking their front court mix where Santi Aldama played a lot for them last year. They, I think they got Jay Huff on a two-way where they're like, that's a 7-foot shooter. And like, they might be trying to find some more ways to open things up. One of the things, and who knows how impactful this will be, Taylor Jenkins changed his coaching staff around somewhat this summer, including bringing in, and I don't have the name in front of me, so apologies, Grizzlies fans and Grizzlies coaching staff. A coach, a European coach who had, I think, like sort of specialized in five out offense. And so there's some potential. I don't know that you're going to be able to run five out with this core, especially if you're running Zach Edey out more. But it's, I think they know they need to iterate and evolve offensively. And I think they know we have sort of some work to do to find out which parts of this all fit best together. And I think that that's, there's a version of this team that they know works, but they also know has maybe a harder ceiling when you get into playoff series. And I think they're in an interesting spot where you want to experiment and find something. Super producer John Gennaro, French league coach. Oh, good luck pronouncing this. He puts in the notes. Let's go with Tuomas Ilisayo. That's probably not right.
Nice.
And I apologize in advance and also after the fact. Because I guess I can't say in advance after I've said the thing. Anyway, they know they have a formula that works, and they know they need to reconfigure it. And they also didn't get answers to those questions. So there's a lot of solving to do, but also a lot of reason to believe that what you have is not only salvageable, but really powerful. So to me, I mean, I think the big question is, like, coming back to it, is that front court. It's starting rookie, Brandon Clark off an Achilles, Santi Aldama ? Two-way Jay Huff ? Like, it feels like they might need another big if they don't want to play Jaren Jackson Jr. at the five more. I'm curious how that's going to work out. Also, what do the closing lineups look like? Because Clark was a huge part of that when he was healthy next to Jaren Jackson Jr. And then, but now, yeah, as you said, you know, there's Smart, there's Ja, there's Bane, there's Vince Williams. There's gonna be,
maybe it's Aldama in the Clark role, right?
Yeah, it could be. You know, that we're gonna try to go five out more and have him stretch. Like, it could absolutely be that, because both those guys also in Aldama and JJJ, they can all put the ball on the ground. They can do more, some more things in that way. Maybe makes you a little bit weaker on the defensive end. Maybe makes you a little bit weaker on the glass, but they might have some more options to play with. I've been kind of bullish on them. I mean, I think generally been bullish on them over the years, but I think they're in a situation where they might hit the ground running and like right away get right back to where the Grizzlies had been before all the injuries and unpleasantness. But an awful lot will rest on Zach Edey, and that is as far as I will go with that in deference to my pal Kristen Peek of Yahoo Sports draft coverage. Another team for me, I stuck in the middle class of the East a little bit, or teams that are maybe not quite in the, I don't know, maybe they could be higher than that. The Cleveland Cavaliers, James, first blush thought, what is your general temperature take on the Cleveland Cavaliers coming off of last season heading into this one?
My take is there's some natural improvement that just should happen. Like if they just get a fringe all-star caliber Darius Garland back, like that is a big deal. And that's what I expect to happen, by the way. Like last year, I don't think that's who Darius Garland is. And then I just want to see what Kenny does, man. I mean, you were talking about five out with the Grizzlies, and I do think that's a really interesting question, in part because I do believe you can play five out even if your center is not a shooter. And the way to do that, I mean, if you guys listen to the Dunker Spot, you know about like delay action where the center is basically your top of the key playmaker guy. And like when Atkinson was in Brooklyn, they played five out a ton with Jared Allen on the floor. It's just he was sort of a hub at the top of the key and everything beneath him was open. And I'm sure he's going to try to do similar stuff with Jarrett, who, by the way, is now a way better playmaker on the short roll than he was when Kenny had him early in his career. And they'll do the same thing, I imagine, with Mobley when he is the five. Also, the obvious question is Mobley going to show more improvement as a three-point shooter, just in terms of his willingness to take them?
Year three of that.
I also wonder, like, in Brooklyn, Jared Allen was shooting threes, not a ton. He was taking them a ton in practice. Like every time I went to a Nets practice, I would see him going around the perimeter, getting threes up. When he got to Cleveland, that was kind of like over. And I think they were trying to develop his sort of mid-range shot first and then work back. I wonder if that player development plan changes with Atkinson there. I know he was, at least a while ago, he was a believer in Allen's shot in the long term. So maybe it's not just Mobley. Maybe it's him as well. And then, yeah, I mean, the Okoro situation obviously isn't sorted out, so we don't know what the heck is happening there. But yeah, I mean, I'm just, clearly they wanted to try a different approach from an offensive philosophy perspective. I actually think Bickerstaff did a pretty damn good job last year, and you saw it especially when the team was shorthanded. So it's not like he, like, quote unquote, deserved to be fired.
Sure.
But once he was gone, I thought the two guys that they were looking at in Atkinson and James Borrego were like, they would be, either one of them would have been an amazing hire. And like now they have Atkinson. I want to see what this thing looks like. I want to see if they're still going to stagger as aggressively as they were in the second half of last year with their guys. I mean, we all know the basic big picture questions about the backcourt and the frontcourt. But I just, you know, Atkinson has a reputation as like really creative guy. So let's see how creative he gets, I guess.
That's exactly right. I want to find something to argue with you. Hang on, I'm going to find an argument. Well,
please.
Just a button on Okoro. Like Isaac Okoro is a restricted free agent. There is yet to be an agreement with him on a new deal. There's also some rumblings, I believe, that he might consider picking up his $11.8 million qualifying offer and then getting to unrestricted free agency next summer. So he's somebody that, yeah, a swing piece, and they're potentially or perpetually rather trying to find an answer in the middle, the wing positions between their bigs and their guards. Okay, here's the stuff with the Cavs. They won 48 games last season, despite Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland, and Evan Mobley missing 84 games.
Yes.
Their big four played less than 400 minutes together. They won 48 games in a playoff series. When Donovan Mitchell was healthy last season, he was fringe MVP candidate, you know, all NBA candidate if had he played enough games. And yet, despite bringing back like every player in their rotation who got more than 500 or 600 minutes and the potential for a healthy bounce back season for Garland and Mobley, like these guys all being back, their over under at BetMGM, not to keep going back to that, is 47.5. So their over under goes down below what they won last year. And I think some of that is just a reflection of there's maybe more confidence, like if the Knicks pick up a few wins and if the Sixers pick up a few wins and if the Cavs, like then there's fewer collective wins to go around. And so sure. as a result, you know, if some of those teams at the bottom of the Eastern Conference are not quite as dire, then like there's it, the wins come from someplace. So I think that's part of it. But I also think there is a collective lack of confidence that that big four, that core, this team as constructed is going to amount to what they had hoped for. The Cavs, meanwhile, are going the exact other direction and saying, we are investing in this. We are extending Donovan Mitchell. We are extending Jared Allen. We are extending Evan Mobley. We are not trading Darius Garland. We are like, we believe this. And so this is a rubber meets the road thing. Are you a gatekeeper or are you a contender? Are you a team that has a real future with this core as constructed? Or are you just kind of biding time until you inevitably have to break it up or sell some parts off and try to find a wing in the middle? We didn't get those answers last year. It moved forward, and it was like before last season, I wrote about the Cavs as like a hero's journey team, where it's like, All right, they've gone through their steps and they've moved one step along at a time. And then last year was another step where they win a playoff series. But it also felt like the end of a version of the story because they're like, although maybe I guess it's just continuing the journey. Well, we shed a coach, we get a new one in, and we now find out if it doesn't advance past that now, then a major look at the fundamentals and the core pieces, I think, has to come. But I also think there's a real chance that like if the injury luck swings back their way at all, and if Garland bounces back at all, and Atkinson is at all able to be more, find more sustainable offensive synergies. Like this team was a top 10 offense 2 years ago. It's possible this is like a 55 win team just waiting to happen. And again, we barely mentioned them in the context of those Eastern serious teams. Maybe their playoff, ceiling isn't quite as high as some of those other ones, but I also don't know in a playoff series, I don't know how many of those other teams have significantly better answers for like, who's going to get us a bucket than Donovan Mitchell. So
they don't. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to get burned on it because I think that general sense of like, it's maybe two teams that kind of got like duct taped together and have yet to really coalesce into a form. And it's like, there's like, or like barbells with like a thin connecting handle in the middle. And like, no, you just need it to all come all the way together.
Yeah.
But I think there's a chance. I do think there's a chance. It's suddenly asking a lot of like Max Strus and Isaac Okoro and Dean Wade and like the collective pieces in the wing in the middle there. But I think that there's a chance that this is like a 55 win team just in plain sight. Am I nuts?
No. I mean, there was a point last year. I wrote a story. It came out like right at the All-Star break, I believe. It was like very, very optimistic about their kind of run that they had just had because they went on this stretch where they were the best team in the league for like 6 weeks or something like that. And a lot of that run, they were not healthy whatsoever. But right when they brought Mobley back, they brought Garland back, they still basically looked like the team that they were without them in terms of the pace they were playing at, in terms of the way that they were moving the ball, in terms of the getting three pointers up. Like I thought those guys did their best to try to fit into the identity that they had created that was working so well for them, which was a pretty simple identity, right? Like, I mean, to have Donovan Mitchell working with a screen setting, like rim running center, and then shooters around them. We saw that for years, and that team just piled up regular season wins, and that's what was happening in Cleveland. This can't exactly have that identity all the time. And I should note that when it did seem like it was carrying over, like Mobley wasn't playing that much and he wasn't finishing games.
Right.
And it was just, and even later, it was like they were heavily staggering the guards and the centers. Like they did sort of have two different teams. Like they had very distinct units out there. So, you know, Strus didn't shoot particularly well last year, but I thought had a great year. His gravity was crazy. He took like part of the reason why his shooting percentage never looks that good is he takes like some of the hardest threes in the NBA.
Absolutely.
Ideally, you get that actual percentage up a little bit next year. Ideally, you just have more threes in general. I think Atkinson's going to love Sam Merrill. I think he's going to that's a guy that just as soon as he gets in the game, he's jacking up a three within like 7 seconds most of the time. So while there is not a lot to talk about in terms of like roster additions, though, if you do go watch Jalen Tyson's summer league highlights, you might just come away thinking that he's like the best player you've ever seen. Like, I don't know what to make of that, because I really didn't know much about him at all going into the draft. And then suddenly he was just like lighting things up and looked like exactly what the Cavs needed. Like, will he even be in the rotation? I have no idea. But aside from that, there isn't much mystery in terms of like injecting new talent here. It's just kind of like, well, how is this going to work? I think just judging by what we saw of Atkinson in Brooklyn, where he came in and he did not quite have, I mean, it was a very makeshift roster, right?
Right.
And his whole thing was, we are going to play a style that I think wins, and maybe we can overachieve with this style. But the point is, we're laying the foundation for like when we have better players here. So their right. shot profile on both ends of the floor was what you would want. They played quite fast. He wanted people pushing the ball. He would get into arguments with D'Angelo Russell about his like mid-range shots that he would take. And he gave D'Lo some rope to do that because he's D'Lo. But like generally, like no one was taking mid-range shots on that team except for D'Lo very occasionally. And, you know, Bickerstaff, to his credit, like wanted the Cavs to move in a similar direction in terms of their offense.
Hunt
last
threes
year
when they could, right?
Yeah, and he had them doing that for a period of time. But Atkinson might be more extreme. It's just I'm curious how it's going to work because it is sort of similar to Brooklyn in the way that like you don't have the perfect personnel, but maybe he'll just try to do it anyway. But the stakes are so much higher. Like this is a really good team that has really high aspirations. And if they are just trying to play five out all the time and trying to get a ton of threes up, but they don't quite have the floor spacers, like I don't know what happens then.
To that gatekeeper versus contender question, last year's Cavs versus under 500 opponents, 27-7 versus over 500 opponents, 21-27. And then against teams with, in terms of point differential, bottom 10 point differential, they were 24-6. Top 10 point differential, they were 10-16. So when the competition gets up, they, you know, floundered. And some of that, again, that's all within the context of a lot of guys missing time, not a lot of minutes with their best guys together. But this feels like a put up or shut up kind of season. Like the investment is there. The belief is there. The new coach is there. The new structure is there. Time to see it pay dividends. Speaking of paying dividends, we are going to take one more break to pay some bills. And when we will come back with our final teams that we're curious about here on No Cap Room. Welcome back to No Cap Room. I'm Dan Devine, joined by James Herbert of CBS Sports. We're talking about teams that we are curious about ahead of this 2024-25 NBA season. We each got one left. It's in the chamber. James, give us your third team, please.
So I had a bit of a theme here. I was picking Western Conference teams that didn't make the playoffs last year that I'm nonetheless very curious to see. The San Antonio Spurs are my third team. Can't imagine why. I just kind of picked a name out of a hat.
Yeah.
Dan, I don't think there's anything that interesting going on there, but I just wanted to give us a challenge to like find something to talk about.
Yeah, the standard no one talks about the Spurs. There's nothing interesting about it, but then they win every year and then we talk about how it's unfair that the national media ignores them. That's all out the window. All it takes is a 7'4" French dude to change that, it seems.
Yeah. And I mean, after watching the Olympics, like my Wemby hype meter, which was already breaking, has now just fully exploded. the pieces of the hype meter all over the floor around me. Look, I don't know how many games they're going to win, man. Like the depth isn't really quite there. The West is just so good. But like simultaneously, if you told me this team was fighting for a playoff spot, I'd just be like, all right, yeah, that makes sense. Because like Wemby's probably going to be in the top five of MVP voting, and he'll win Defensive Player of the Year, and he'll be first team All NBA, and this is all happening in his second season, and that was just how it's written, I guess. Like, he is insanely good. I think, you know, some of the stuff he was doing at the end of the year, and some of the stuff that I thought, weirdly, even though Wemby is covered to death, like, I didn't think he necessarily got enough credit for in the Olympics, was like, his defense was like dominant on virtually every possession. And then he was also like the best passer on the floor a lot of the time. So his game is just growing every direction at the same time. There are like big obvious questions about like, all right, like, what's he going to look like as a 3-point shooter consistently? Like, what's he going to be as like a go-to ISO post-up guy? But like, he is like, without touching the ball, he changes things on both ends. Without shooting offensively, just his presence changes everything. There has never, ever been a player like him. He's going to elevate everybody around him. I think there are some opportunities to do interesting things with lineups that they couldn't do last year, whether it's just putting Harrison Barnes out there and trying to maximize the spacing, whether it's having a bunch of ball handlers out there at the same time. Like, I mean, there's nothing stopping them from playing CP and Trey Jones together. I am just curious about how this whole thing will look. I do have some like questions, like, you know, we heard like the stats that like Zach Lowe would cite all the time, right? Like the starting five, when it was Jones, Vassell, Keldon Johnson, Sohan, and Wemby were like dominant, but it was only 142 minutes.
Right.
Actually, I don't even know how many games that group even started, if any, because Keldon a lot of the time was coming off the bench. But that unit was like plus 20.8 net rating. Jones, Vassell, Wemby, like plus 9 in 806 minutes. Just Jones and Wemby, plus 4.3, which is like not dominant, but considering like what their overall net rating was as a team and what their record was as a team, like over like 1,288 minutes to have a plus 4.3 net rating with those two guys. When Jones is not like a star, he's just like a, like, you know, low mistake, competent point guard. Like, that tells a story, right? So now you introduce some new stuff into the mix. Does Harrison Barnes start? If he does start, is it Keldon Johnson going to the bench? Is it Jeremy Sohan going to the bench? Does Castle maybe over the course of the season prove that he actually is like all they see him as, like, but faster? Because maybe he ends up playing like 30 plus minutes a game in the starting lineup. Like, I think that guy's ceiling is obviously super high. So, yeah, I mean, I think we don't know exactly what they're trying to do. Like, we don't know how many sort of development minutes they're still going to be for, you know, guys like Branham, guys like Blake Wesley. But, you know, I think if they stay relatively healthy and if they really put an emphasis on like trying to go for it and trying to make a run at the playoffs, play in, like, it could happen. Like, I think you need CP to be healthy. You need Barnes to, like, you know, do the thing that he always does, like shoot like, you know, almost 40% from three and kind of be available.
Right.
But I mean, Wemby just alone, I think, is going to make them a pretty damn good defensive team. And then offensively, they have more options than they did.
To me, you're absolutely right to point to the number of questions that there are to answer. And it's still, it feels accelerated because a prospect like Wembanyama, and then not even a prospect, a product like the you actually saw it in on the court, just makes everything move faster. But it does still feel comparatively early in this building process, right? There's still, it's a lot of young guys, a lot of sort of low repetition, low minute count groupings, and a lot of them coming without ideal service, ideal spacing, ideal, you know, complement of how a team needs to sort of coalesce. But within that, as you said, like, there's a point of there's a proof of concept already. Like, I think that, and I mentioned this, our buddies Joe Wolfon and Joe Cash at The Score, their you know, dearly departed Pound the Rock podcast, we talked about this, the idea that positional size on defense and like defense being sort of a weak link system of like, if you can eliminate the easy places to hunt, even if everybody is not elite all across the board, but they're like big and not easy targets, it can be the fastest way to elevate you from bad to decent. And there are many problems with Jeremy Sochan in the construction of that roster, right? But generally speaking, Wembanyama, Sochan, Vassell on the court. So you've got, obviously, Wembanyama, positional size, I think it's fair to say. Devin Vassell, you know, good length on the wing at the two or three spot. Sochan, whatever, wherever you slot him, big, 6'9", you know, good wingspan. They gave up 109.4 points per 100 possessions with those guys on the court last year. It was about 2,000 possessions. So, like, the offense struggled, but they were plus, like a net positive with a top two or three caliber defense with those guys on the floor. I think you draft Stephon Castle because you're thinking, we want our point guard eventually to be big. The guy that we mm-hmm. want on the court in these, like, we don't want our guards to be someone you can pick on easily, because we think if we are big everywhere, we buy the player, the prospect, the pedigree, we think his shot will come along. Not that it's easy to do that. Perhaps also tougher in San Antonio now that Chip Englund's not there. But the general idea of like, this guy is big and tough and long, and we could guard pick and rolls with Castle at the point of attack and Wembanyama behind it. And yeah. I think that's like a pretty direct pathway in theory to, we are going to be a top five defense no matter what. And then how we mm-hmm. develop our offense around it, I think, is a pretty interesting question. But how big an impact do you think Chris Paul actually makes on this team at this point?
I think he could be sort of transformative.
I thought you were going to say. So say more. I want to hear that.
Well, I mean, I think the simplest way is, last year there was an enormous difference in how competent the Spurs looked offensively just based on whether or not Trey Jones was on the court.
1,000%.
Now, even if you just cloned Trey Jones, that would have been so helpful. I think Chris Paul, even at his advanced age, I think he is flat better than Trey Jones. No shade to Trey Jones. Paul is still such a good, effective, smart offensive player. He is going to get guys the ball where they need it. He is going to just orchestrate that system to the point where Wemby doesn't have to create a ton of shots in isolation that are like, you know, these step backs and fadeaways. Like, he'll do some of that because he's Wemby and he wants to, and he wants to explore his game. But I think Wemby will find that his life is easier, particularly late in games when Chris is on the court, because this is what Chris has been doing forever. I think Devin Vassell, by the way, like, one of the more interesting players in the NBA for me coming into the year. He's improved a lot, even though it doesn't always show up in the stats. Like, if you just look at how he's developed as a pick and roll player from early on his career until now, like, it's night and day. Even his body, like, he's so much stronger, he's so much better able to take contact, which has made him a better, more aggressive driver. Still probably could do with getting a little more aggressive instead of taking as many mid-range shots as he does, but I think he might end up taking fewer of those anyway, just because Chris will be setting up for more spot up looks and more opportunities to attack closeouts and get all the way to the basket. And even simple things like, you know, Chris is known as a slow it down half court kind of, you know, I'm going to maximize this possession and make the other team rotate a bunch of time. All this, like, when he wants to, he can just like get the ball up quickly when he sees an opportunity. Like, we've seen him do that. And I think he might be able to just sometimes get Vassell the ball quicker when he has an opportunity to just go. So I think, yeah, the big question is, how many games is he going to be able to play?
Right.
But what he should do for their half court offense, I genuinely do think it can be transformative.
I love the idea too of just like, with the brief interregnum of his time in Golden State, which didn't work out really to the way anybody would have wanted it to go. But the idea of Chris Paul late career being just sort of like a traveling salesman of basketball bullshit to everybody, like, I'm going to spend like 1 or 2 years in a different city with a bunch of young guys who don't really know how to do anything yet. And I'm going to be like, all right, I show up, I teach class, everyone goes to my dojo, and then I go on to a new city. And I, you know, inform I bring the gospel of organized basketball to the world, yes, one city at a time, with Oklahoma City and then Phoenix and now here San Antonio. And, you know, we'll see how it goes. But before we get out of here, just a reminder, Victor Wembanyama over the final 41 games of last season, so last 3 months, 23.1 points, 11 rebounds, 4.5 assists, 3.9 blocks, 1.3 steals in 30 minutes a game. And that's as bad as he's going to be. So I think if nothing else, the transformative nature of Chris Paul is maybe that there won't be like a 25 game sample of the season where no one throws a lob to the guy who's the size of the Empire State Building. So maybe, yes, if nothing else, we have multiple guards who say, I'm going to throw it up that way, is as high as it can go, and see where we go from there. You talked about your theme out west. I wanted to balance this out. I'm a fair and balanced host, if nothing else. Fill-in host, but if nothing else. I stayed on the East, and I stayed with that sort of, again, that middle class. And to me, the last team that I'm curious about that I wanted to talk about today is the Miami Heat. And the curiosity that I have listed here in my notes is, so, like, what's the plan here, guys? Because I understand structurally in terms of your salary structure, your financial future, they were pretty limited in what they could do underneath the aprons and with, you know, in terms of bringing guys back or bringing talent in. That said, 46 win team last season, eighth in the East, lost in one play-in game, lost Jimmy Butler in that play-in game to a sprained MCL, win the second one, get one win off the Celtics by hitting a franchise record number of three-pointers, and then go out pretty meekly thereafter. Lose Caleb Martin for nothing because he walks into the Sixers cap space. Delon Wright goes to the Bucks. They add a couple of players in the draft. They bring back Kevin Love and Haywood Highsmith and bring in Alec Burks for the minimum. And then that's kind of it. You know, yeah, I mean, like, shouts out to Alec Burks. Listen, he made himself, if nothing else, he made himself another minimum in the playoffs with the Knicks and also made enough people wonder why he wasn't playing more minutes all along. There were reasons why Alec Burks wasn't playing more minutes all along, guys. And then the big sort of two-headed monster of this summer for the Heat is they extend Bam Adebayo, the maximum they could extend him, 3 years and $165.3 million, player option in 28-29. Like, he is the standard bearer. He literally got the key to the city of Miami yesterday. He's the guy. He's the centerpiece. They pointedly do not extend Jimmy Butler enter into even discussions with it. I'd mentioned this when we talked about the Heat a few months ago, but from Pat Riley's end of the season press conference in late April, quote, "We have not discussed that internally right now. We have to look at making that kind of commitment. And when do we do it? We don't have to do it until 2025, actually, but we'll see." That's a big decision on our part to commit those kind of resources. And here's me emphasizing with my eyebrows and my voice, unless you have somebody who's going to be there and available every single night. Jimmy Butler has not done that, has not been able to do that. Has not played 65 games in a season in the last 5 years, has missed an average of 20 games a season in Miami, turns 35 next Sunday night, or next Sunday, I don't know when he was born, next Sunday. And this is kind of like, what is the case for optimism here, James? Can you find me a silver lining or a glass half full, generally speaking, with what we're seeing in Miami?
I don't know that I can spin the offseason because they got unlucky with the Martin thing. I mean, Martin would have been better off taking their offer than the one they ended up taking. He just misread the market, or his agent did.
There's just no, if you thought you were a mid-level exception guy, it turns out you were wrong because no one, with the exception of DeAnthony Melton for 1 year in Golden State, like nobody was a full mid-level guy this year.
Exactly. So it's hard for me to spin that. I would, if I'm trying to be glass half full, I would say, well, all right, like, we haven't seen that much of Terry Rozier with this team. Jimmy Butler is, like, you know, I think still you can, like, probably pencil him in. I would bet Jimmy Butler has a better year this coming year than he did last year.
For no other reason than apparently money's on the line for it.
Money is on the line for it. And also just, I mean, I just don't think he's done. I really don't. And I think, you know, he was not himself fully last year when he was on the court. He missed a lot of time. I do think, like, I would not be surprised if he is just back to his, like, normal all-NBA form next year. I think there's some optimism you could take about Bam Adebayo based on what you saw from him late in the year in terms of starting to shoot threes. He carried that over to at least the first stage of Olympic play.
That's right. Had Dwayne Wade screaming Bamante, and which I hope maybe that'll persist. Maybe that'll continue into the new era of Heat basketball. We'll have all sorts of announcers screaming Bamonte. We'll find out.
Yeah. And LeBron was saying he was another Splash Brother. So they have that. And then, you know, you're just hoping for, you know, some progression from Hawkes, who I think had a really good rookie year. Maybe he comes back and he's suddenly a knockdown shooter. That would help, because they don't have, I mean, they have a couple of those, but they don't have a lot of guys, maybe any guys who are knockdown shooters and actually able to hold their own defensively. So that would be something. But I don't know the chances of that. They're in a really weird spot, Dan.
Right.
I'm a positive guy generally. And I think the biggest thing is it's hard for me to get excited about this team. But the Heat in the past have kind of come out of nowhere and found a way to be better. Maybe it's a trade that they pull off with some disgruntled star, involving Hero's contract or Rozier's contract or Robinson's contract. They do have a lot of stuff they can move. They don't have a ton of guys that other teams are really begging to get from them, but they have some picks they can throw in and stuff like that. And they do have, if they're willing to let go of, say, a Jovic, that's a guy who had a pretty good year last year. So, I mean, you're kind of counting on improvement from Jovic. You're counting on improvement from Hawkes. And then you're just hoping that Jimmy is kind of healthier and better, right?
I think that's a huge component of it. You know, the general idea of every time I say general, I think of Jimmy being out with general soreness a few years ago in Minnesota, and just the images of him as general soreness. that is pretty much anathema to Heat culture. So it's a while in the rear view there. Forgive me. I'm an old man. I think you're right to point to when you have Jimmy and Bam, and you have them on the court more, you have them healthier, you have them more available, that gives you a higher floor, right? And it was underwhelming last season because a lot of it was underwhelming, but they were, I think, 33-27 when Jimmy played, about 5 points per 100, plus about 0.5 points per 100 when Jimmy and Bam played together. Not elite, but good, right? That is a good team.
Yeah.
And there were all these snippets of, you mentioned the Terry Rozier acquisition, then he gets hurt pretty quickly, but there was a 15 or 20 game sample where he was around 19-4-4 on pretty good shooting. And they were a plus in the minutes he played with Bam. Again, not big plus, but a plus. Jovic, I think, is really interesting because he didn't really get into the rotation until Christmas. When he got in there, his minutes were not huge. I think it was only 20 minutes a game, but the shot was there. And I think that the geometry of what they could be offensively with a big stretch four who can, do a little bit with the ball.
Yeah.
It potentially opens up more. And I think that's the main, and this is a little bit facile, but it's the main potential cause for optimism here. Is, obviously Eric Spoelstra is Tony Stark in a cave with a box of scraps every year, right? He's going to figure out how to make an Iron Man suit. And the idea here being that offense has kind of deteriorated and really bogged down into a lot more isolation play. John Jablonka at a good Heat blog, All You Can Heat, broke this down recently to sort of it used to be Bam and dribble handoff, Jimmy and dribble handoff, a lot more Hero running off handoffs, Duncan Robinson running off handoffs, Strus running off handoffs. And then over the last several years, the percentage of their offense that has been those sorts of handoff and cuts has really decreased. And the amount of it that's ISOs and post-ups has really increased. And I think some of that is just that's where Jimmy and Bam are, best of, in terms of generating their own offense. Some of it is that's where Hero is most confident as a on-ball playmaker, right? Doing more pick and roll and more ISO. Whether that's always the best thing for their offense, then the ecosystem, I think, is an open question. And I'm hopeful that, if you get a step forward as a shooter from Hawkes, you have Duncan Robinson's back from the dead, right? Maybe more Jovic as a legit shooter. You bring back Love. You have more front court spacers. Maybe Bam shoots more. There's maybe some more, if you are able to get Rozier on the floor, he's a legit volume distance shooter, a guy who can pull off the dribble or be a spacer off the catch. There's just more guys who can move and shoot. And maybe that just introduces more dynamism, because I don't think they're going anywhere with an offense that was bottom 10 last season in offensive efficiency, effective field goal percentage, attacks at the rim, rim accuracy, and clutch time offense. Like, they were just bad in every kind of offense. And even if you're a top five, top six, top seven defense, you're just not going anywhere without some spice there. So I think the hope is, like, on one hand, either those young guys do take those steps, Spolster's able to, you know, democratize the offense a little more, decongest it, get some more movement and some more shooting on the floor, and those guys take the steps either to A, be better for the Heat, or look good enough that somebody decides, I'd like those guys in addition, and I'll take on the Hero contract, because I think the market maybe has spoken a little bit on Tyler Hero in terms of what the league sees him as. This plus that plus a pick, maybe that does get you into some conversations. I don't know, but much to be considered there. James, you got any final thoughts on the Heat?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because they do have a ton of guys that can make plays, right? Like that's why they got Rozier. And then if you're looking at this as a healthy roster, like, you're looking at Jimmy and Bam and Hero that can all kind of, and Rozier can all kind of make stuff happen one-on-one. You know, like, Jovic is, like, he is a stretch four based on, like, you know, like what you were talking about. He's also a playmaking four. Like, that's part of his appeal.
Yeah, that's the idea, is like, you have him as somebody that can combine and be not just a standstill guy, but also someone that can make something happen there between Jimmy and Bam.
Yeah, I think that's the whole point of him. And Hawkes also, like, he is a do everything guy, but he is able to make stuff happen with the ball in his hands. Like, there are kind of the pieces to have a lot of different weapons and have a dynamic offense. It's a tricky thing because some of these guys, like, I don't know how often you really want to play like Hero and Rozier together, for example. Now, Duncan Robinson's a big part of this team. It's been tricky. I mean, they do the zones, they do everything, but like, it's always been the question of how much can you play him next to Hero. And yeah, the offense going to more post up and ISO, like, when it first started happening, it felt like, all right, this is a reaction to like what happened the previous year in the playoffs. It's like a lot of playoff success is built around like, just get into whatever you're doing quickly, go attack, get an advantage, get an extra defender, and go matchup hunt. And the Heat do that. Like, they go matchup hunting, but you need spacing to do that well. And Spo has historically been one of the coaches that has been most creative in terms of finding ways to balance spacing and defense by doing unconventional, weird things. But this roster really puts that to the test because they just don't have a lot of guys who do both. They have some guys that are duplicative. I think they're one of many teams in the NBA where you're like, a consolidation trade would be really nice. To just kind of make this roster make a little bit more sense. But clearly the trade market was like really, really difficult for a lot of teams this summer, and the Heat are no exception there. So I think like we are looking at a roster that I doubt was the front office's plan A.
Sure.
a few months ago, and it's just kind of what it is. Just like, you know, Terry Rozier, I think they're happy to get Terry Rozier, but we all know what they were trying to do a few months earlier. So they're trying to make the best of what they have, and it's an imperfect roster, but like, it is an intriguing amount of talent and even an intriguing amount of scoring for a team that wasn't good offensively. They need someone to put some damn pressure on the rim. Shout out Nekias Duncan. They need to put pressure on the rim.
Shout out Nekias. Well, James, I put pressure on you to come up with basketball things to talk about in the first week of September, and you succeeded with flying colors, and that is all that we've got for you today. Before we get going, James, anything that you would like to plug or promote? People can find you where?
All my work is at cbssports.com. I don't really have anything to promote. I'll promote Ellie the Elephant, whose shirt I am wearing right now.
That's right. Ellie the Elephant, breakout star. One of the many breakout stars of this WNBA season. I'm going to promote Duck the Cat, James's cat, who is a lovely feline who James sends a holiday card to me every year of his cat. And it's one of the highlights of my holiday season. James also, James is going to be modest here. He doesn't have maybe a specific piece to promote. James does wonderful analytical breakdowns and also great feature writing at cbssports.com. So I highly recommend you check that out. Also, follow him on social media at Outside the NBA. You can catch his stuff there. That's all we've got for you today on No Cap Room. Thanks so much to James again for spending some time with us in the NC Armada. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro, who does all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. Subscribe to the Ball Don't Lie podcast on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on. Leave us a 5-star review. Helps us with discoverability and spreading and growing the show. I think that's about all. We thank you so much for listening, and we would appreciate it if you would come back again in 2 weeks. We're on our off-season schedule still, in 2 weeks for another episode of No Cap Room.